Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. ESG, or Environmental, Social, Governance, promises to help the bottom line and the planet at the same time. Is it too good to be true? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of an episode digging into that very question.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Nearly 4 years ago, Mark Polymeropoulos took a work trip to Russia. He was a senior intelligence service officer more than 2 decades into his career at the CIA. He was in good health and unsuspecting of what was to come.
I made a trip in December of 2017. It was a routine trip, but, you know, something bad happened on that night in Moscow. I woke up in the middle of the night to a start. I didn't hear anything, but I had an incredible case of vertigo. So the room is spinning. I had a terrible headache and I had what's called tinnitus. I'm ringing in my ears. It's wildly disorienting. It's actually quite terrifying. I'd spent years in the war zones in Iraq and Afghanistan. I've been shot at many times. I put my life in some extreme danger, but this was pretty scary because it was a loss of control. So the next morning, I called, you know, my contacts at the embassy. I said, you know, something bad had happened. And we actually went together with one of the embassy officers, took me to a pharmacy. And, you know, this was because I had this extreme case of vertigo. We were trying to find some medication that would help. And I remember sitting at a restaurant in Moscow. And again, the extreme vertigo and the splitting headache, you know, returned. And basically, I kind of just powered through the trip. And then I came back to the United States. And as I really wasn't getting any better and, in fact, got worse, that's when I went to see the CIA's doctors and told them that I think something bad had happened. And unfortunately, you know, their first reaction was, which was the same reaction that lasted, you know, for several years, really, was to dismiss any of my concerns, even when I was really, really suffering. You know, the headaches and the dizziness were so bad that ultimately I couldn't even go to work. You know, after a very kind of successful career, I retired the equivalent of a 4-star general. I was very senior at the agency, but I was only 50 and had a lot more left in the tank. When I finally got treatment at Walter Reed's National Intrepid Center of Excellence, which is one of the world's renowned traumatic brain injury programs, you know, we go through something that's called art therapy. And it's really pretty extraordinary. But one of my colleagues painted a picture. It was a picture on a black canvas and just a red splotch, which looks like blood. And he called it the gunshot. And, you know, why is that significant to all of us? Well, it's because all of us wish we had been shot. All of us wish there's something visible, because then people would have what? They would have believed us. For many of the victims, it's deeply disturbing when they read an article saying that we're all kind of, you know, it's all psychogenic, we're all making stuff up, or we have panic attacks. I mean, clearly, that's not something that happened to me. And the joke, you know, I'm going to sound silly when I say this, but, you know, panic ain't in my DNA. I spent a lot of time in Iraq and Afghanistan. You know, you can call me a lot of things, but I'm not one to panic. I did not have a panic attack in Moscow in December 2017. I can assure you of that. What's happening against these officials, like what happened to me, is what I call an act of war. The official U.S. government name is an anomalous health incident, but let's call it what I think it is. You know, if we don't push back, if we don't kind of detect, you know, defend and then deter this, you know, this is going to have a really deleterious effect on our ability to, you know, project American power and force and represent the United States overseas. And so it is an enormously serious and complex issue, because if we don't get this right, you know, we can't do the job, which is, again, it's acting as America's first line of defense.
Mark Polymeropoulos, former senior intelligence service officer at the CIA. Now, what he describes has now been experienced by many other American officials abroad. It's come to be called Havana Syndrome. Adam Entis joins us now. He's a staff writer at The New Yorker, and he has done the most in-depth reporting on Havana Syndrome anywhere that I can find. Adam, welcome to On Point.
Yeah, it's good to be here.
So for people who don't know or aren't familiar with the details around what exactly Havana Syndrome is, take us back to the beginning. Havana being Cuba, that's where it was first sort of detected. What happened back in 2016?
So, you know, we have a relatively small CIA station in Havana with just a few number of officers. And in December of 2016, shortly after the U.S. election and the death of Fidel Castro, one of those officers reported to the medical office that at the embassy, at the U.S. embassy, experiencing strange sensations of sound and pressure in his head that were followed by an array of bizarre symptoms that included, you know, headaches, dizziness, difficulty focusing the eyes, things like that. When this was reported, people frankly didn't know what it was. And to be honest, they still don't know what it is. The same individual reported a second incident. And the way it was described to officials that I spoke to was the person felt as though they were standing in what was like a beam of energy, and that when they moved about their house in Havana, it would follow them. And if they were behind a wall, it would stop. And when they were in front of the wall again, it would start up again. This was also reported. And then another CIA officer reported. Eventually, it was, as best I could tell, I don't know the exact number of CIA officers since they were operating under diplomatic cover in Havana. It began to spread through the entire station. And I don't know if anybody was unaffected by this. And then it began to happen. Similar experiences were being reported by members of the State Department and consular staff at the embassy in Havana. And that's how it started.
And so so it was beyond sort of the intelligence services, beyond the CIA. You're talking about the diplomatic corps as well. And so where did the people first report that this sort of beam of energy sensation had hit them? Was it always in their homes or in various places?
It was, in my understanding, it was always in their homes. And, I don't know if you've ever been to Havana or to Cuba, but it's, you know, it's really a police state. And, the diplomats all live in a similar area, close by to each other. And outside their homes, in many cases, there are police security force, small huts where the security force people are 24/7 constantly. And so it's not the kind of place where, you know, things could happen without those security forces picking up on the presence there of threats to these diplomats. And that's really the reason why at the beginning of the Trump administration, they decided in the absence of really any intelligence to support what they decided to do, they decided to basically say the Cubans are ultimately responsible because they control the territory, they control the land, and therefore it's their responsibility to make sure that these diplomats and spies were not being subjected to this, what they believe to be attacks.
Huh. And yet it hasn't been limited to Cuba, right? Because we heard from Mark Polymeropoulos a minute or two ago, and he said what he suffered happened in Moscow. So where else around the world have people been felled by Havana syndrome?
Right. So it starts in Havana, and you have, you know, dozens of cases being reported by embassy workers in Havana. Mark's case is sort of, you know, kept quiet within the CIA when it's reported by him in later in 2017, early 2018. What happens later is that, in the spring of 2018, you have a cluster of reported incidents being reported in Guangzhou, China. Those cases are reported, and frankly, there's a lot of confusion in the U.S. government about what's going on. I think the critical context here is, typically when something strange happens that is believed to be the act of a foreign adversary, the U.S. intelligence community is able to is often able to detect pick up intelligence that will allow them to make an assessment of which country is doing this, what's being done. So they believed, you know, certainly the CIA director at the time, Mike Pompeo, believed that these were attacks. That's why he closes down the CIA station, takes the extraordinary step of closing down the CIA station in Havana. And they launch an investigation, both a medical and intelligence investigation. And frankly, the intelligence investigation comes up with nothing, which is unusual. Usually, you know, even though our adversaries are in some cases extremely good at hiding their track, usually something can be found eventually. And the intelligence community wasn't finding anything. And so what starts to kind of creep into, you know, into the minds of some of the senior people at the CIA and at the FBI in particular is skepticism that this is really happening. And in the absence of intelligence, theory begins to take hold, particularly in the FBI, that this might be psychogenic illness.
Yeah.
So where some people have experienced something, and that information is shared with their colleagues, and they all are effectively living in what amounts to a fishbowl in these various embassies around the world. And as that information spreads, people begin to think that it's also happening to them. So the idea that this might be psychogenic sort of takes hold at the top ranks of the CIA in the absence of any intelligence that points the finger at an adversary or points a finger at what specifically is being used to cause these symptoms.
Well, it's been, 5 years now since the first cases in Havana. So when we come back, we're going to talk about other findings. We're going to talk about where the government stands at the moment on Havana syndrome and really what it means that this mystery hasn't actually been solved in half a decade. So Adam, stand by for just a second. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. A recent episode featured a debate about ESG or environmental social governance.
This sounds like more work than just putting your money into a social impact fund.
It's a lot more work.
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks there's an easy solution here is either engaged in puffery, greenwash, or deceiving themselves.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking about the ongoing, continuing mystery of Havana syndrome. And Adam Entis joins us. He's a staff writer at The New Yorker and has done the best reporting on Havana syndrome anywhere that I can find. And Adam, before we talk sort of more about how the U.S. government has responded to the many cases now that we have around the world of officials, you know, suffering these attacks abroad, I did want to talk a little bit more about where they're happening. Because over time, as you said, it spreads from Havana to China and other places. And I was looking, like, even more recently, we have a U.S. diplomat in Serbia evacuated by the CIA last month. That was according to a Wall Street Journal report. Even in India, an aide traveling with a CIA director developed symptoms. This summer, I think a trip to Vietnam scheduled by for Vice President Kamala Harris, that was actually delayed after a couple of officials in the U.S. Embassy and in Hanoi got ill. And as you, of course, well know about all of these cases, even in Vienna, the CIA replaced its station chief because of reports of Havana syndrome there. And we haven't even talked about the cases that have happened right here in Washington, D.C. Can you tell us about those?
Sure. So, yeah, I mean, the first cases that I've discovered involving a high level U.S. delegation, like the example you gave of Hanoi, for example, where the vice president was traveling, and the cases were reported just before her arrival in 2019 in the spring. Trump was going to London for a state visit, and members of the White House kind of advance groups, so senior, you know, officials who were going to be there for the state visit, checked into their hotel in London. One of them, a female White House employee, was in her room, and she reported feeling being bombarded with pressure when she was by the window of her room. She then has a colleague come to the room later on during the same visit. And both of them are together in the room, and they look at each other, and they both feel the pressure, and they both hear the pain. They rush out to the hallway, and it subsides, which is very similar to what was described by some of the victims in Havana. They come back from that trip. This is the first case that involves a senior U.S. official delegation. This in that case involving Trump, and there was you know, the NSC National Security Advisor at the time, John Bolton, and his deputy really believed that this was Havana syndrome that affected these two White House employees. And they put pressure on the CIA. They kept on telling the CIA, you need to get to the bottom of this. And the CIA would say, well, we're trying. We just can't find anything conclusive on this. One of those White House staff members, the one who was affected first in London, she lives in Virginia, Northern Virginia, not far from just outside of Washington, D.C. And she was with a friend, and she was walking her dog with the friend, and she noticed a van across the street, and she felt again the pressure and heard the sound in her ears, and she sort of doubles over in pain. The friend doesn't feel it as acutely, and she goes into her house and she reports that to the White House. That's the first domestic case that I'm aware of being reported.
Huh.
It's not the last. You know, what follows is, you know, later on in the Trump administration, towards the very end, there are two other White House officials who report episodes that are similar to this as they're, you know, on the ellipse, which, as you know, is is right underneath the White House. They, in one case, I spoke to that individual. He was leaving his office and felt the pressure and the pain, doubles over in pain, makes his way to his car on the ellipse, can't drive, can barely see, hails a taxi that takes him to the hospital, and they think he's having a stroke. Later they conclude he's not having a stroke, and frankly, they really don't know what happened to him. And he himself was uncertain if this was Havana syndrome. This is part of the difficulty of this, is many of the symptoms are rather common and, you know, could be caused by other things.
So you talked about the theory that it was psychogenic, a.k.a. sort of like a mass hysteria event that's ongoing in different places around the world. Let's put that aside for a second. We're going to come back to that in a moment. But with the theory that this is a deliberate attack being executed by some entity, government, I don't know what, but it's happening in so many places around the world, including right in Washington, D.C. I mean, what is that telling investigators?
Well, this, you know, the idea that this is that at least some of these cases are our attacks is the hypothesis that's accepted by very senior government officials in the intelligence community at the White House, in both the Trump administration and the Biden administration. That's their belief. And obviously they see this as, you know, a tremendously dangerous escalation in what before this has been, harassment is not unusual in places like Havana and places like Moscow. It's not uncommon for, it hasn't historically been uncommon for U.S. diplomats and spies to be harassed. You know, they would come home to their apartment and they would find a cigarette butt in the ashtray that they know they didn't put there, or they would notice that their furniture was moved around as a way for the domestic security service to send a message to the American, you know, we're watching you. You better be careful. That's typical. Mm. That's typical conduct. But for it to get so violent and so dangerous is considered to be a remarkably dangerous and occurrence, and one that has tremendous implications if the intelligence community is able to determine what's happening and who's behind it. That's referred to as attribution. And if they're able to attribute this to who they believe it's is responsible. Now, the theory within the government at the highest levels is that the Russians are behind this. I have not seen any intelligence to back that up. This is what they believe, and so we should approach it with caution, this information. But imagine if they do get enough intelligence to point the finger at the Russians. That's a game changer. Obviously, the relationship between the United States and Russia is terrible, and this could make it exponentially worse if the intelligence community decides with high confidence that the Russians are behind it, which they have not been able to do based on their investigation so far.
Right. So that's key. And, you know, in fact, it actually brings to mind the Arthur Conan Doyle quote about once you eliminate the impossible, whatever remains, no matter how improbable, must be the truth. But eliminating the impossible is still the process that the United States government is in, right? And so, for example, in 2019, there was a report that came out of the National Academy of Sciences, and the report was headed by Dr. David Relman, and he took a look into Havana syndrome, and he spoke with NPR and talked about the study and its results.
So we deliberately chose to focus on just a handful of mechanisms that had been suggested to us by work that had been published already or by suggestions from our sponsors. These included microwave radiation, chemicals, and in particular pesticides, infectious agents that might have been common in Cuba, which is where many of the cases that we looked at had taken place, and then finally, psychosocial mechanisms. And the mechanism that we found most plausible was a form of microwave radiation that occurs in a pulsed or intermittent form. We were not confident, and I have to be clear, we viewed this as plausible, but again, we didn't have any direct evidence that this could explain the entire story for sure, or even parts of it.
It's Dr. David Relman. Adam Entis, tell us a little bit more about this 2019 report and what it was able to conclude, if anything.
Right. So, you know, what's going on here, just so you understand, is after those two incidents in London, John Bolton is trying to get Gina Haspel, who's the CIA director at the time, to focus on this, increased focus on this. And there's a lot of frustration that the intelligence community was not able to, and had not until that point been able to reach any conclusion about what was going on, and couldn't even say if it was real, and couldn't say who was doing it and how they were doing it. So Relman's report was greeted within the administration, at the end of the Trump administration, with it was welcomed because it was the first report to kind of offer, an, albeit in an incredibly heavily caveated way, pointed at least partially to what Relman and members of his expert panel were able to assess. And like you said, like he said in that clip, you know, which again, very heavily caveated, mm-hmm. was that the most probable explanation of those was the idea that this was microwave pulse radiation. And I think also significantly was the rejection of the idea that this was psychogenic. And, you know, the reason why that's important is there was a theory that was promoted in part because the FBI's behavioral analysis unit had made an assessment of the Havana syndrome victims. Let me say that they made this assessment without actually interviewing them directly, that this was psychogenic illness. And so for Relman to deem that to be unlikely, and he wasn't the first to do that, by the way. There were previous studies that were done by doctors and experts on traumatic brain injury at the University of Pennsylvania, who first were treating the patients. They had also ruled out psychogenic illness. And so, you know, Relman basically with his report took a small step in the direction of, you know, basically saying this appears more likely to be caused by radiation. But as he says, he doesn't have concrete evidence of that. And that remains, you know, the biggest hurdle to solving this mystery. And, you know, that could change, you know, relatively quickly if the intelligence community is able to, you know, find this evidence. But it's my understanding, you know, that remains still elusive.
I mean, that's not just a big hurdle; it's a spectacularly large hurdle. I mean, we're talking about, you just said, like, they just don't even have any evidence that concrete evidence of the that it was an attack. So I'm curious about what even the kind of evidence they might be looking for. Like, what would it look like that would either confirm or reject the theory that it is an attack?
Right. So, you know, they have some very dramatic cases. I think the one that I find to be the most dramatic is one that took place in an Asian capital. And it was a military officer who was driving his car, and his young child was in the back seat. I believe he was 2 years old. And they're stuck at an intersection in heavy traffic. And suddenly the driver of the car, the military officer, feels a tremendous pain and pressure in his head. And at that exact same moment, his son in the back seat starts screaming at the top of his lungs. Mm. This military officer had served in combat before. And so, you know, people who serve in combat know that when you think you're under attack, the expression is you get off the X, you get out of the area. And so he gunned it. He gunned the car out of the intersection. And as soon as he got out of the intersection, the pressure in his head stopped and the pain stopped, and his son in the back seat stopped crying. And what happened was in that case, and this was sort of in some ways a breakthrough case, the intelligence community has various ways of identifying the presence of Russian intelligence officers. We all use our cell phones. You know, if the government knows that number, it's called the selector. If they know how to identify that phone when it touches a cell phone tower, connects to a cell phone tower, they can track that phone. So what happened in that case and in some of the other cases is they were able to identify, based on the pinging of those cell phones, a Russian military intelligence operative located at the same intersection near the car of the U.S. military officer at the moment of that incident. And so this was seen by some in the intelligence community and at the Pentagon as as strong evidence that there is a correlation here, that that the Russians pointed, that they believe that evidence points to Russia.
Uh-huh.
There was a very similar incident in the same Asian capital involving a CIA officer who was also, driving, had a similar incident. My understanding is there was no child involved in that case. And also they were able to, using the same, it's called geofencing or geolocation, to identify a GRU, a Russian military intelligence officer or operative in the vicinity of that CIA officer.
Yeah.
So there have been, there's evidence like that that is being closely examined to see if they can basically identify Russian military intelligence officers in the vicinity of the victims.
Yeah. Well, Adam, let me just jump in here for a second because we do have to take a quick break here. This is so fascinating because, look, if this were a movie, the next scene would be, you know, intelligence officers tailing those GRU agents to find out where they're going and what they may or may not have in their cars. But obviously, this is real life and not a movie. And so I'm going to want to hear from you and the next guest that we're going to bring on. Like, why are we not making progress in understanding what's causing Havana syndrome? So we'll be right back with a lot more. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And just a quick heads up for tomorrow's show, we're going to be talking about algorithmic home buying. It's technology that lets you sell your home literally in just a couple of clicks, no real estate agent involved. And of course, it's an algorithm on the other end that's making you the offer. Now, one huge player in algorithmic home buying, Zillow, recently had to pause their buying because essentially the market schooled them on the value of the homes that Zillow was buying through AI. But we want to hear from you. If you sold your home this way to Zillow or Redfin or Open Door, those are some of the big players in the algorithmic home buying space, or if you purchased a home that way, what has the experience been like? Tell us your story at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. That's for tomorrow. Today, we are talking about the ongoing mystery of Havana syndrome. And these are these attacks on U.S. officials abroad that causes pretty significant changes to their brain and even brain damage. And why, after 5 years from the first case, the United States still doesn't know who's doing it, how they're doing it, or why. I'm joined by Adam Entis. He's a staff writer at The New Yorker and has done exquisitely deep reporting for many years on Havana syndrome. And earlier in the show, Adam mentioned about the FBI and a 2018 internal report the FBI published that concluded that symptoms experienced by victims of Havana syndrome, that they were suffering from psychogenic illness, essentially. That report was later called deeply flawed. We reached out to the FBI about it, and they would neither confirm nor deny the existence of any specific investigation, but they did point us towards testimony from FBI Director Christopher Wray that he gave before Congress earlier this year.
Our role is doing interviews of victims and pursuing the investigation from both a potential criminal but also national security type perspective. But again, it's a victim-focused effort at the moment, and we are going to make sure that if we can figure out who is responsible that we leave no stone unturned in holding them very firmly unaccountable. Because if this is an attack, it's totally, totally unacceptable.
Well, joining us now is Frank Figluzzi. He's a FBI assistant director, former FBI assistant director for counterintelligence. He served in that post from 2010 to 2012, was a special agent at the FBI for 25 years, and is a national security contributor to NBC. Frank, welcome back to On Point.
Glad to be here.
So I do want to know, from you and your on-the-ground experience, Adam was telling us a little bit earlier that we do have cases in which later on it's been able to determine that, a GRU agent or some kind of foreign agent was in the vicinity of some of these Havana Syndrome attacks. So ideally, if that much at least is known, what should happen next in an investigation to find out more?
So first, investigative efforts in this have to be centrally coordinated, and I'm not at all certain that that kind of centrally coordinated investigative effort is truly happening. I'm still seeing signs of stovepiping every agency for themselves, and these are huge bureaucracies. When you talk about Department of Defense, State Department, CIA, and other agencies that really haven't been in the forefront of this story, that have victims of their own, you're talking about huge bureaucracy. So investigation has to be centralized first. Now, investigative steps, yes, this kind of geopositioning of locating the Russian intelligence officers, the GRU officers, or for that matter, other suspected foreign intelligence services officers, you're talking about a nation state, likely a nation state that's doing this with significant sophisticated capabilities to put people on the ground in all of the places we've named and more, even in generally denied police states, places like China, Cuba, as we've talked about. It's very difficult for a foreign intelligence services to get on the soil there and do things with free license without the host country knowing it. So when you boil that all down, you've got to put people in places at precise times and say, we've got you here. Your people were here at this point and this time.
You know, you said it's hard to put people on the ground there. And I do wonder, there's been a long running, I don't know if it's a debate in the intelligence services, maybe it's not anymore. But from externally, I look at it and I think, well, there was a time we had a lot more people on the ground, right? We had human assets on the ground, but we started relying on technology more. Is that part of the problem here, Frank?
And it's a bit of a chicken and the egg, right?
Yeah.
Because, yes, we've reduced human assets around the world. It's been harder to do that. We do rely more on technology. And here we are with a scenario that actually erodes and degrades our ability to put more people on the ground as morale is impacted, as family members say, I'm not going on that assignment with my loved one. It gets harder to post intelligence collectors around the world and develop sources around the world.
Hmm. So I just have to take a step back here and ask, because I know that there are listeners who are wondering this. We're acting as if we're speaking of this in terms of the United States being this victim of these unrelenting series of attacks. And I think there's factual evidence that things have happened to U.S. officials. I'm not denying that at all. But I know that listeners are probably like, well, don't we as the U.S. do the same thing to officials in the vicinity of U.S. soil or U.S. embassies? Like, is this just a part of the tradecraft when it comes to international intelligence or the way we try to mess with other countries? And what's frustrating us in the United States right now is we just can't figure out who's doing it or why, Frank.
Well, it's a great question. I would push back on the notion that the U.S. intelligence or military does this kind of thing to civilian adversaries that impacts family members in particular. This would represent quite an escalation over what the U.S. does and does not do. I will tell you, though, in a related thought, I think in the early days of this investigation, there was some concern that our own equipment, our own communications equipment, or our own ability to our techniques to jam adversaries' communications or shield our comms or encrypt our comms was somehow blowing back on us. I think that's been discounted, but I think that early on there was a concern, like, gee, are we somehow responsible for this? And I think communications, encryptions, jamming, I think that's at the heart of this, that some country may have realized at some point that their use of equipment to jam or intercept our encrypted comms may actually produce a weapon. And now we've got a weaponized situation.
Well, you know, you said something a little bit earlier, Frank, that I just want to pick up on. And Adam, I'm going to turn back to you in a second here. But the stovepiping, right, of these massive agencies. After 2001, we were supposed to have created a brand new view of intelligence services that was supposed to prevent exactly that kind of stovepiping, right? So what are some of the other sort of obstacles to really pushing forward our investigation of what's going on? Frank, go ahead.
Yeah, here's the issue. I think there's a couple of things. Bureaucracy, number one, and we've talked about that. Novelty, number two. We've not seen this before, right? Mm-hmm. This, as many years as this has been going on, and I think there's evidence that it's been going on long before the Havana incidents were reported. And then the gravity of this, meaning that you've got to get this exactly right, because as we've talked about, this is tantamount to an act of war. So if you're going to fix attribution on a certain country or intelligence service, you've got to get it 100% right, because if we respond accordingly, this is going to get very ugly very fast. And it needs to involve our allies. The investigation should involve our allies. Are we the only Western country experiencing this? That's part of the coordination of the investigation and should be part of the coordination of any response we launch.
Oh, so those are really good questions. Adam, let me turn back to you. I mean, do we have any insight about whether this has happened to any other country or representatives of other countries?
Well, in the case of Havana, yes, you know, this, there were also similar reports being made by Canadian diplomats who were also situated in some of the same neighborhoods where the Americans said they were affected. And what you have to keep in mind there is the Canadians have a very different relationship with the Cubans than the Americans did. You know, as you know, the United States relationship with Cuba has been fraught since Fidel Castro took power. In the case of the Canadians, however, the relationship has actually been quite close, and Canadians traveled in large numbers, have long traveled in large numbers to Cuba. So it seemed strange that the Canadians would also be affected, but there were many reports of them being affected. I'm not aware of any other countries' employees, spies, or diplomats besides the Canadians and the Americans reporting episodes like this. Those are the only two countries that I'm aware of.
I have to say, I'm still taken aback by how hard this is to untangle. What concrete evidence would actually look like? Because I don't know, maybe it's just my love of technology, but I was thinking about, again, the geolocating of the GRU agents. But on the other hand, I mean, in a lot of these countries, any time a U.S. official leaves their residence or the embassy, shouldn't we just presume that they're being tailed anyway?
No. Yeah, that's why I think the geolocation data is circumstantial evidence, because yes, depends on your position at the embassy, but depends on the country. But if it's a country that has a large kind of Russian intelligence presence, they're going to have a tail on every senior person who's leaving the American embassy. So why are only certain small numbers of them being affected in this way? You know, but there is some. You know, there is some data that potentially could be useful that the CIA and the State Department are currently testing. One thing that has been shown in studies of TBI cases, traumatic brain injury cases, involving, you know, sports, involved in sports injuries, for example, as well as military injuries on the battlefield in roadside bombings, for example, is that when the brain is shaken violently, There are certain proteins that are released into the bloodstream that can be basically they could draw blood and test the blood to see if they can see elevated levels of these proteins. There are three main proteins in question here. And right now, actually, we're kind of in the early stages of seeing whether that technique can be used in order to have specific physical biological evidence that something is actually happening to these individuals. And so what they're doing now is they're doing blood tests, they're drawing blood of CIA officers voluntarily before they go overseas. The idea is that if one of those individuals later reports an episode that sounds like Havana syndrome, they could draw their blood and then compare the two samples to see whether their earlier sample, is different. How is it different from the sample after the incident? And that could be one way to begin to solve this mystery.
Right. So we're running down on time here. We're looking at 3 minutes left. But Frank, let me turn back to you for a couple quick questions and then Adam on a round out with you if I could. What do you think, Frank, from your experience in counterintelligence in particular, someone's perpetrating these attacks and they're doing it around the world. We can't figure out who it is yet. But what kind of message do you think these attacks are designed to send?
Well, first, there's been increasing reports. Some good reporting is happening on this, and sources are being developed. I think the strong theory is developing that we are likely looking at Russia. We've got to get that right, as I said. But this is part of a greater phenomenon across the geopolitical threat called the asymmetrical threat, whether it's cyber attacks, denial of service, whether it's social media propaganda, and now even Havana syndrome. We're looking at non-traditional warfare. This is the new threat. And so when you look at the intention and capability of the Russian government, a government that's proven it's willing to poison and murder its own people on other soil, right? Then clearly, if they're willing to do that, then there's a willingness and capability and intention to do something like this. And it's not just, quote unquote, messing with our intelligence collectors and diplomats, but rather it literally could degrade the ability for us to post assignments, collect intelligence overseas. I think this is what we're going to be looking at into the future. There are very few intelligence services capable of doing what we've just described repeatedly in multiple locations. So that's Russia. It would be a very, very strong theory.
Wow. Okay. So we've got about a minute left. And Adam, last question to you. I'm just fascinated. What has it been like trying to report this story? Because we've got incidents around the world. No one really has a firm grasp yet of what exactly is going on. And you're dealing with, the intelligence services. I'm just curious, how hard has it been to make any progress in trying to understand what's behind Havana syndrome?
Well, frankly, what I've found to be the hardest part of it in some ways is trying to kind of stay agnostic while doing the reporting. So when you talk to the victims, you can tell that they're really hurting, and that they have no reason not to be truthful in describing what happened to them. At the same time, that the intelligence community has yet to produce concrete evidence. So trying to be down the middle on this one while we wait for the evidence one way or the other to appear, that's been difficult because, everybody's frustrated. They want answers. And we just have to be honest with our audience that we're just going to have to wait for the answers to come in. And it's, I think, a mistake for anybody to make assumptions either way, that it's psychogenic or that this is a Russian microwave weapon. I think we just have to wait for the investigation to produce concrete results.
Well, Adam Entis, staff writer at The New Yorker, thank you so very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Frank Figluzzi, former assistant director for counterintelligence at the FBI and NBC's national security contributor. Frank, thank you so much for coming back on the show.
You're quite welcome.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
Can profit motive save the planet? Is a company that takes the climate into account a better investment? How about one that pays workers a living wage and champions transparency and board diversity? That's the idea of ESG, or environmental social governance.
Sounds like a wonderful story. You can make more money, you can save the planet at the same time. Almost no one is going to turn that down.
It's a story that Andy King of Questrom and Veet Henish of the Wharton School challenged during a recent event at Questrom. Professor King played the critic, who says these are problems for regulation to solve, not markets.
As a famous economist said to me, you can't fix externalities with the profit motive, because the profit motive is not linked to externalities. Externalities are the byproduct of pursuing profits. So you can't fix them by getting people to even look harder at profits.
Meanwhile, Veet emphasized that ESG can be an important part of the solution.
Regulation matters, and we need better regulation. And we need to reallocate trillions of dollars of capital over time to the climate transition alone, forgetting social justice, racial justice, and other ESG issues. We're going to need the profit motive for that. No government regulation is going to reallocate tens of trillions of dollars of capital alone. It's going to be investors who are looking at current government regulation and future government regulation and trying to connect the dots.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.